This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Lebanon's Hezbollah says Saudi Arabia and Israel helped the U.S. assassinate Iran's top commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and the culprits must pay the price. Britain and Turkey are set to sign a free trade deal, the first since the UK secured a post-Brexit trade agreement with the European Union. Also ahead, more than 1,000 refugees are left to sleep in the freezing cold after a fire destroyed their camp in Bosnia. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour: the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says Saudi Arabia and Israel helped the US in the January assassination of Iran's top commander Qasem Soleimani. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said the assassination was probably requested by Riyadh and Tel Aviv. Nasrallah said he even had information that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had also requested the Hezbollah chief's assassination after U.S. President Donald Trump took office. Hezbollah Secretary General was speaking with Lebanon's Al Mayadeen television station. He criticized Saudi Arabia's policies that he said are rooted in hatred towards the resistance front in the region. Nasrallah also praised the personality of Iran's General Soleimani. He said he will give a full speech on Soleimani's assassination anniversary next week. People in different countries have honoured the memory of top Iranian commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the US in Iraq a year ago. The slain military figure is remembered by many as a charismatic resistance leader. Our correspondent Amin Alami tells us more.
Afghans are a nation with a long history of resistance against various enemies. Since 19th century, Afghanistan has been invaded by different armies: the Colonial Army of Britain, the Red Army of the Soviet Union, and the Black Army of Terrorism, along with its international backers. They all tried to break the will of Afghans. As experts say, the existence of a resistance spirit among Afghans has helped them to make contacts with other resistance figures beyond the Afghan borders. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was one such figure who was interested in having ties with anti-terrorism and anti-hegemony resistance movements, mainly across the Middle East and some other Asian countries, including Afghanistan.
Lieutenant General Soleimani was popular in many societies like Afghanistan. He was a charismatic leader who fought terrorism and helped many oppressed nations to strongly stand against terrorism.
Many others also believe that the charismatic personality of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani revives for Afghans the memory of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud. It becomes more interesting when you understand that both Soleimani and Massoud had friendly ties before Massoud's assassination, only 2 days ahead of the 9/11 attacks.
Lieutenant General Soleimani had a transnational personality. He had close ties and cooperation with our national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud and Professor Rabbani, who were leading anti-terrorism resistance in northern Afghanistan.
Let's not forget that many here in Afghanistan believe the slaying of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was leading regional resistance against terrorists, is not an endpoint in the fight against terror. Rather, his assassination has made the resistance front all the more determined in its campaign against terrorists. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
So 1 year has passed since the US assassination of top Iranian commander and resistance icon Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Our correspondents have talked to a number of Syrian and Palestinian people about the assassination.
Qasem Soleimani sacrificed his life for the sake of Palestine and spent his life fighting for Palestine. His legacy will never die because thousands more Soleimanis will be born and a new knight will lead the way.
His memory will remain forever in the hearts of Palestinians and Iranians. The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was especially harsh for all of us in Gaza who remain under siege. The absence of Qasem Soleimani has encouraged Arabs to normalize their relations with our enemy. His martyrdom was a great loss for Palestinians who will find it harder to liberate their land. Since his martyrdom, Israel has stepped up its aggression and siege against the Palestinians.
Martyr Qasem Soleimani was a symbol of devotion and sacrifice for Syrian people. The services he did are unforgettable. He will remain in the memories of the coming generations in Syria. Words cannot describe his efforts and his sacrifices.
Qasem Soleimani.
May he rest in peace. He was a commander and a hero, a big hero, and a symbol of steadfastness and sacrifice for us, especially here in Syria. I congratulate him on his martyrdom. Not all people are worthy of such martyrdom. The U.S. did not achieve anything from his assassination, because one Qasem Soleimani is gone, but 10 other Qasem Soleimanis will come. He stood alongside Syrians from Aleppo to Damascus. My brothers fought under his directives. They were ordinary fighters, but they told me he used to dine and spend time with them. He was so down to earth.
Soleimani was not the first and will not be the last resistance figure. The path of resistance on the way of Imam Hussein will live forever until liberating the last inch of every occupied land. Soleimani was a fighter, a struggler. May he rest in peace. He stood beside us. There are hundreds of others like Soleimani.
Elsewhere, Britain and Turkey are set to sign a trade deal, London's first such accord since it clinched a key post-Brexit agreement with the European Union several days ago. In a statement, British Trade Minister Liz Truss said the deal, to be signed on Tuesday, will mirror the existing trade terms between Ankara and London. She expressed hope that a new agreement will be reached soon that would better fit both Britain and Turkey's trade interests. The UK has entered into trade agreements with 62 countries since formally leaving the EU in January. Trade rules between the UK and the EU have remained unchanged since then, but from the end of this year, London will be treated by Brussels as a third country. Elsewhere, more than 1,000 refugees from Asia and North Africa face winter in dire conditions after a Wednesday fire engulfed their camp in Bosnia. There were no casualties when the Lipa camp went up in flames, but much of the infrastructure was destroyed. The camp was set to be shut for winter refurbishing on Wednesday, the same day as the fire. Police and UN officials said the blaze was probably started by the asylum seekers, uncertain about their future following the temporary closure of the camp. The incident deepened the crisis over where to house the refugees. The European Union has repeatedly asked the authorities to find an alternative to the camp, warning of an unfolding humanitarian crisis. The number of COVID-19 cases in South Africa has passed the 1 million mark, making it the first African nation to record such a high figure. According to the country's health ministry, in total, nearly 27,000 people have died of the coronavirus. South Africa is currently suffering a second wave of infections, of which the majority is a new fast-spreading variant of the virus. Authorities are considering reimposing restrictions to rein in the spread. The country's president is also expected to give a televised address later this week to brief the nation on the latest measures. Morocco is the second hardest hit African country with more than 430,000 cases and over 7,000 deaths. Meanwhile, more nations are reporting cases of a new COVID-19 strain that recently surfaced in Britain and spreads faster than the previous version. Jordan has confirmed its first two cases of the new variant in travellers who had arrived there from the UK. Portugal also detected the strain in travellers from the UK. Officials did not specify the exact number of cases. In Canada, a couple was found infected in Ontario province. Local officials are now calling for a province-wide lockdown to contain its spread. Many countries in and outside Europe have already reported infections related to the new COVID variant. they have imposed travel bans on the UK to control its spread. Austria, meanwhile, begins a nationwide COVID vaccination program prioritizing nursing homes, healthcare personnel, and frontline workers. Up to 10,000 doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine entered the country on Saturday, and officials say the country will receive over 4 million doses by the summer. Homolecki reports.
The first person vaccinated against COVID-19 in Austria, an 84-year-old pensioner who says she wants to see her children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren again without hesitation. The first five volunteers who received the initial doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine included three elderly patients with underlying health conditions and two healthcare personnel. According to the manufacturer, a certain protective effect should already exist 7 days after the first of the two doses is injected. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz and Health Minister Rudolf Anschober, who were present for the vaccinations at Vienna's Medical University, spoke of a historic day.
This is the beginning of the victory against a pandemic and a game changer. We move to normalcy step by step with every vaccination that is carried out.
But the two officials warned of challenging months ahead.
Today marks a turning point, but the fight against the coronavirus has not yet been won.
Anschober said that by the summer, over 4 million doses of the vaccine would be available in Austria, which has a population of almost 9 million. The vaccination is expected to be rolled out in three phases, starting with those in high-risk groups, over 80-year-olds and medical personnel in the first few weeks of January, and continuing with frontline workers. And from April, the rest of the population, excluding those under the age of 16. Austria entered into its third hard lockdown on Saturday, with the Chancellor warning against a third corona wave and a massive increase in infection numbers across Europe.
Officials have made it clear that another year of recurring lockdowns is not an option. The hope is that with more vaccinations, that can be avoided. Homolezki, Vienna.
Millions of Americans have lost their unemployment benefits as President Donald Trump keeps refusing to sign a coronavirus aid bill. Two federal unemployment insurance programs ended at midnight on Saturday. That has left some 12 million people without any source of income. The U.S. president has described as a disgrace the $900 billion relief package approved by Congress. Trump has demanded bigger direct payments to U.S. taxpayers. The stimulus is attached to a broader funding bill. Therefore, a government shutdown could happen if Trump refuses to sign the bill by December 29. President-elect Joe Biden has warned of devastating consequences if the incumbent continues his refusal. The number of daily coronavirus deaths in Iran has hit its lowest level in over 3 months. The health ministry on Sunday reported 119 new deaths in 24 hours. It confirmed just over 5,500 new infections in the same period. The last time Iran witnessed a lower figure was on October 20, when daily infections were almost 5,040. The country tightened coronavirus restrictions more than a month ago. It has now extended the curbs to lower risk cities to sustain a recent fall in daily cases and deaths. So far, over 1.2 million people have got COVID in Iran, with over 54,000 losing their lives. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are struggling to cope with COVID-19 and the large number of infections amid the Israeli blockade. Under-equipped hospitals in the impoverished enclave are overwhelmed by the increasing number of coronavirus patients. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
On International Day of Epidemic Preparedness, Gaza's health sector continues to suffer due to the Israeli blockade. Coronavirus infections have skyrocketed in the Gaza Strip, which is one of the world's most densely populated areas. Despite the increasing number of COVID-19 infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medicines and hospital equipment. Human rights organizations say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic.
The Israeli blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, and especially on the health sector. The health sector is suffering from an unprecedented deterioration due to lack of medicines and medical supplies, as well as trained medical personnel to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus pandemic has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver.
Our people are suffering because of the Zionist blockade under the watchful eye of the international community. The situation has only gotten worse amid the coronavirus pandemic.
As infections continue to rise, experts are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the coronavirus.
The humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip is catastrophic and is getting worse by the day. The health sector is unable to provide proper medical care to coronavirus patients and even struggles to provide tests for the deadly virus. Gaza has a population of over 2 million and hospitals don't have enough beds for the patients.
The COVID-19 pandemic remains a serious concern due to the capacity gaps in the enclave's health system. Hospitals in the tiny enclave lack medical facilities and medicines to tackle the deadly virus due to years of Israeli blockade. Israeli inhumane practices have battered Gaza's health sector since 2007. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The only center for treating children with leukemia in Yemen suffers from a lack of medicines and medical supplies, causing an increase in fatality rates by up to 50%. This is while international and relief organizations have failed to do their part to save children's lives. Our correspondent Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
More and more Yemeni civilians die in Yemen on a daily basis amid the continuation of the Saudi siege on the Arab country. Here in the Pediatric Leukemia Treatment Center, 50% of patients, namely children, die due to the lack of medicine and medical care they need to survive.
We've suffered a lot to establish this center so that children could have a chance to survive, especially due to the difficulties of traveling abroad. During the past 6 years, we received hundreds of cases, but the death rate is still high. And we hope that the concerned international organizations will do their role so the children could have a normal recovery.
Hundreds of children come to the center from all across Yemen, as it is the only medical center for such patients, hoping that they will receive the required treatment. However, the ongoing war and the crippling blockade have made the center suffer from a permanent shortage of medicines, medical supplies, and radiation devices.
The families of patients come from remote areas. They also face lack of medical supplies. Also, the treatment for leukemia is marrow transplantation, which is very expensive and is carried out outside the country, which is not possible due to the continued siege and the closure of Sana'a's airport.
I come from Al-Mahwit Governorate, which is very far away, and we face a lot of trouble traveling to reach this center, which suffers from a constant shortage of medicines and overcrowding of patients, as it is the only center in Yemen.
The health sector in Yemen is in a dire need of necessary support from international and relief organizations, which have not played their role in alleviating the suffering of the Yemeni people that began in March 2015 due to the Saudi war on Yemen.
Hundreds of children lose their lives at the gates of the center due to the lack of medicines and other medical supplies, as well as their inability to travel for treatment due to its high costs and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
It is hard to comprehend the magnitude of the crisis in Yemen. Approximately one child dies every 12 minutes in a country where 24 million people need humanitarian aid. Nearly 18 million people have no access to clean drinking water, a problem that will worsen in the future. For Yemenis, COVID-19 was only the latest epidemic. The country has in recent years faced outbreaks of malaria, dengue, and cholera. Even the outbreak of COVID-19 did not stop the Saudi-led U.S.-supported violence. As a result of new attacks, more than 18,600 people died between January 1st and December 5th, 2020, according to the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, ACLED. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Isa Ferreira Ryder. This article is published under the heading Yemen's Humanitarian Crisis Worsened Amid COVID. Stay tuned, please, for the details. For Yemen, 2020 has been an apocalyptic year, which has exceeded even the worst forecast for a country that has in recent years been ravaged by war and humanitarian disaster. Even the outbreak of COVID-19 did not stop the Saudi-led U.S.-supported violence. As a result of new attacks, more than 18,600 people died between January 1st and December 5th, 2020, according to Armed Conflict Location and Events Data Project, that is ACLED. In a 2018 interview, Robert Malley, who led the West Asia desk of U.S. National Security Council during the Obama administration, recognized that the disastrous consequences of military intervention by the Saudi coalition was a very likely outcome. He said it was the poorest country, Yemen, to begin with, being bombed by the wealthiest country in the region, that is Saudi Arabia. Yemen has been the victim of a regional dispute, but also of Western powers. A coalition led by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which the European Council on Foreign Relations describes as having access to some of the most sophisticated and expensive military technologies in the world, has been able to use the bloodiest tactics. As Martha Mundy, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at the London School of Economics, wrote in her report, the strategies of coalition in the Yemeni war, these include a blockade on sea, land, and air, which used hunger as a method of war, and indiscriminate attacks on the civilian population and food production. To commit such atrocities, the Saudi coalition needed decisive logistical assistance from countries including the United States and the United Kingdom. The consequences have been brutal. According to a report from April 2019 by the Pari Center for the United Nations Development Program, as well as data from ACLED, the death toll in the nation since the beginning of the war far exceeds 250,000 and may even be close to 300,000. It is hard to comprehend the magnitude of the crisis in Yemen. Approximately one child dies every 12 minutes in the country, where 24 million people need humanitarian aid. Donald Trump's foreign policy has repeatedly tried to undermine the humanitarian crisis in the poorest countries. Two such recent attempts were the efforts to suspend aid to Yemen in March of this year, followed by Trump's decision, announced in May, that the U.S. would leave the World Health Organization which will have a disastrous effect if Biden does not rejoin the organization. The U.S. withdrawing its funding will translate into abandonment of millions of people who depend on these funds to survive in Yemen. These endeavors were unsurprising considering the Trump administration's support and its blank check for Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Meanwhile, there are high expectations for the new administration. Despite having been the vice president under Barack Obama, who supported the war in Yemen, Biden has been pushed to reassess the U.S. relation with Saudi Arabia due to pressure from progressives and unpopularity of the war. The war is not the only catastrophe to have befallen Yemen this year. Heavy rains between spring and summer caused immense damage and displaced 300,000. In fact, Yemen is a clear example of the tragic consequences of the climate crisis, the effects of which amount to more than just floods. Nearly 18 million people have no access to clean drinking water, a problem that will worsen in the future. For Yemenis, COVID-19 was only the latest epidemic. The country has in recent years faced outbreaks of malaria, dengue, and cholera. That latter is a perfectly preventable disease that should be eradicated, reminds us that while the world was seeking vaccines for COVID-19, people in Yemen were suffering the consequences of living without clean water. Worse still, the healthcare system in Yemen has practically collapsed. The extent of COVID-19 outbreak in Yemen is not currently known, but it is likely that the number of deaths in the country is much higher than the 607 deaths reported by WHO. Satellite imagery used to estimate the burials between April and September in the port city of Aden, but the excess mortality in the area at 2,100 compared to 1,300 deaths expected. The economy is also in ruin. Since 2015, the value of the Yemeni rial has fallen to $800, down by more than two-thirds of its pre-war value, while the population increasingly depends on the remittances that Yemenis send from countries such as Saudi Arabia. But these payments have also been affected by the COVID-19 crisis, as many overseas workers lost their jobs, meaning the money being sent home fell dramatically. The international community worsened the disastrous situation when it began to reduce humanitarian funds sent to Yemen. This has had dire consequences, and the United Nations has called for more funds to prevent humanitarian programs from collapsing, warning that millions of children are facing deadly hunger. Mark Lowcock, the UN's Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, warned that the humanitarian crisis in Yemen has never been worse, while the Secretary General Antonio Guterres recently claimed that Yemen is now in imminent danger of suffering the worst famine that the world has been in decades. As Lowcock said, Yemenis are not going hungry, they are being starved. Less than half of the humanitarian aid requested by the UN has been sent. That is, a further $1.75 billion is required. Meanwhile, tens of billions of dollars were spent on Western arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates during the war. This contrast invites reflection. The duty of democratic countries is to avoid unimaginable disaster. There is no time. Western governments must act now, by stopping sending arms and instead providing immediate funds to the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. And in this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear sister.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So in our previous discussion, we began with this question stating that what are the common mistakes that parents usually do when upbringing their children? And you mentioned some, one of them being that we make them too dependent on us sometimes.
That's right. See, these are so innocent things, yeah? But yeah. We forego them. We don't know that they're really, hamper the child in the long run.
Exactly.
Another thing that often... mistakenly happens is that not being careful with the spouse in front of the children.
Mm.
When you quarrel, for example, it's natural for couples to have occasional arguments, of course, and sometimes even it tends up to be heated and bitter arguments, but it's very damaging to carry out in front of the children.
Yeah.
It's very important because children do not understand this relationship too much, so it's they don't even understand. It's not a cause of worry. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
They're natural arguments. But children don't understand that this is like something very...
Maybe not so big,
yeah,
you know. That.
But they feel that it's a very big thing.
Exactly.
So it depresses them. And they begin to imagine the worst things.
That they'll get divorced.
Yeah, exactly. So it could be a sign that the parents don't love each other, don't love the children. And maybe sometimes even they feel that it's their fault that all this is happening.
Exactly.
You know, the arguments that the parents are doing so much for them, and now the child feels the lack of security. So this causes a depression and a lack of security among the children. And it could have damaging effects to the child as he grows up. And he would also begin thinking that this is a normal way of how couples should treat each other.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, when it would have a major, major effect on his own relationships also.
Exactly.
And he wouldn't treat, for example, or she wouldn't treat her husband, the wife, in the manner that Islam wants us to. So it's very important to be very careful of your husband or the parents between each other when you are confronting, when you are near the child.
Yeah.
You should have the seclusion that not near the child all these things should come up. Some parents also tell children to take sides.
Mm.
It's so bad. It gives such
very
a bad,
bad
effect that sometimes the wife feels that her husband is not treating her fairly. Yeah. So she may talk to the children and tell them the bad things.
Yeah.
Like it's a
make
very
them go against the father. For
yeah.
instance.
And that will even affect the relationship between the children and the father in the long term.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't be like to look upon, somebody to look upon as a father.
Exactly.
They would feel that the father always mistreated their mother. And that's a very bad thing, you know. There would be no respect and love for the father then. And this happens when they're children. It's terrible when it happens when they're children, especially. Because it'll leave a mark in their hearts that the father is unfair on them. Or vice versa also.
Yeah.
Also, it happens when you deprive the children of love and respect for the extended families. It's a great wrong to tell them things about their aunts and uncles.
Yeah.
And, to fill them up that so-and-so did so-and-so in this stage. And this is, and then they will not feel like doing Sile Rahmi. So it gives a big effect, you know, in their lives.
Yeah.
Because Sile Rahmi is a thing that is incumbent in Islam. It's
very
keeping
much.
Ties with your aunts and immediate family members.
It is very important for us to be careful with how we behave with our children about others as well.
Yeah, in front of the children, there are certain behaviors that should not be taken for granted.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, thank you very much. So we're going to take a short break, and inshallah, after the break, we're going to continue this discussion.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing.
Another mistake that a parent often makes is that she has or he has wrong expectations from the child. Maybe they expect too much from him, beyond his capacity, beyond his age limit. Some parents would like their children to behave totally like adults.
Yeah.
Especially when they take them out, they feel that the child should be pin drop silence.
Shouldn't dirty things.
Exactly. Especially if they are small. Mm. Or if they are a bit big and they say silly comments, the child says no. Don't say anything when you're outside.
The parents
again,
the child,
killing their self-esteem, as we talked about earlier. So they don't want them to run around, to play, to talk loudly, touch things around the house, and they don't understand, they fail to realize that all these activities are part of growing up.
Yeah.
To be a healthy adult, a child needs to have passed these various stages, each of which is a building block in his character.
Exactly.
You know, that determine the other characters. It's like a building block. If that is not formed properly, the later things don't come in properly. They don't fit in properly. So, in this regard, I would like to mention a hadith by Mufazzal, our sixth imam, describes the wisdom behind the childish behavior, which some adults dislike.
Mm.
It's very nice to reflect upon this hadiths of Mufazzal, because they are to deal with creation and why a child behaves childishly, for example.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the parents don't, they have so many expectations from the child. So this is why a child behaves childishly. The reason.
Wow.
That if a child had been born with mature intellect, he would have been astounded on opening his eyes and seeing such a varied assortment, a variety of assortment, different kinds of forms and distinctive images of unity and disunity. For a long time, he would not understand where he came from and where he arrived, and whether all that he was seeing was in a state of dream or wakefulness.
Oh.
If he had been born with mature intellect, this is still the hadith,
he
would have felt disgusted and degraded on feeling himself being carried about in the lap, fed with milk, and wrapped in, for example,
cloth.
Pampers, bandages. He would feel disgusted about it. He would say that, no, I wouldn't, because he would be able to rationalize,
He
would feel ashamed.
Feel shy.
But a child is a child, you see. They would not have been, if they had been born with mature intellect, that sweetness, nor that consideration for infants in the minds of adults which come from fondling the untutored child. The sweetness and the innocence wouldn't be there anymore. Their artlessness creates a particular attraction. As such, he is born into the world without an understanding for anything, quite unaware of the world and what lies therein. He views all these things with his undeveloped brain and inadequate understanding, and so does not feel perplexed.
Mm.
He doesn't feel, he's so, you know, like normal doing his activities. Whereas the parents here feels that, you know, ashamed, feeling ashamed in front of others. She shouldn't. A parent should feel, in fact, take him to places where she knows she wouldn't be, you know, like told off.
Yeah.
Especially when a child has this habit of touching things. Choose your places where to go. Go with the, you know, in houses where parents have children.
Yeah.
Not in parents that they decorate their houses in such a way that you can't even touch one item.
Exactly.
Another phrase of the hadith says that his intellect and understanding develop by degrees, slowly from time to time, little by little. This introduces him gradually to the things around him and then accustoms his brain accordingly to grow up and to accept everything around him.
It's like Allah has planned this all.
Yes, it's planned.
Okay, thank you very much. We are just going to take a short break, and after the break, we're going to continue this discussion. Thank you. Stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, he who has a child must treat him in a childish manner.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Okay, so you're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So, what are the other wrong expectations we have from kids?
Yes, there are many wrong expectations that sometimes we as adults have towards our kids, and that messes about everything. And for example, the child lives in a world quite different from ours, and their perspective is different, you know, and it's very important for themselves also. So if you meddle with them, you know, their perspective, we may ruin things altogether. For example, if we don't allow a child to have a little of his own independence, to, you know, meddle with things that he's interested in, for example, if the consequences are not very destructive, I mean, we should give him the chance to investigate for himself, and, you know, his inquisitive nature, like, demands it, that definitely, he should experience and learn. Right?
Yeah.
That children like learning through experience, and themselves too. So we should try to give them that much space, you know, so that they can experience and learn. But if you become so rigid and so, you know, disciplinary attitude, you know, then they wouldn't learn so fast, and they wouldn't even learn how to make their own decisions in future.
Very
so those
true.
Are the mistakes adults do by thinking that the children are so disciplined. Whilst that is not the real thing wanted from the children.
I think they feel like this is in fact what's good, that, you know, trying to be disciplined and making sure our kids from a young age, if they learn to be like this, then, you know, when they grow up, they'll be perfect, you know?
Yeah, they don't know that this will actually do more harm than good.
Yeah, exactly.
It's good to give some flexibility in their life.
Hmm.
A small thing shouldn't be treated like a major issue, you know?
Yeah.
So parents should be wise enough to think over this matter, and not to, you know, make the children feel that they are so much in a, like a restricted.
Yeah, they should try and put themselves in their children's shoes.
Yeah, like sometimes, you know, it happens when you want to go out, for example, and you give this rigid behavior in the child's mind that you have to behave this way.
Yeah.
You don't have to move. You have to sit besides me, otherwise I'll pinch you from the back and things like that. It was practiced in our times way back, and parents who brought up the children in that era, till now, unfortunately, I hear parents saying that so-and-so children are so naughty. They can't sit in one place. They don't know children are.
Exactly.
They are supposed to move, investigate, be happy. And the sawab goes to the parent who feels that, no, let them be given space.
Yeah,
to.
I think the older times people, they feel like we are doing a mistake if we let the children, you know, have their own space. They feel like, no, then they're not going to be nurtured properly. They're not going to be disciplined.
Yeah.
Then you have to scold them sometimes. You have to be rigid with them. But because they don't know, you know, now that we've got more experience, we're learning more, we're understanding that this is, in fact, a necessity for a child, you know.
And they don't want to listen also. They want to just stick to their views, unfortunately.
Exactly.
But these are the wrong expectations to have from children. I mean, I feel that now that knowledge has progressed so much, books are so much, you know, like at our disposal, so such grandparents also should think about it and should read and should come with terms with the fact that these are wrong expectations to have from the child. That if you take the child out, he should be so, you know, well-mannered and things like that. And they translate well-mannered into sitting into one place and not, you know, asking questions or not talking a little loudly, for example.
Yeah.
We hush them off. And
Unfortunately, then, like, when there are those children who are disciplined and there are those who are naughty, they would turn to the discipline and say, look, these are so,
exactly,
you know, perfect. And what's wrong with, you know?
And then there's a gap always, like, you know, in those children.
Hmm.
They feel a bit complexed.
They feel we're not good enough.
We are not good enough. Or, you know, it gives less self-esteem than the required, that Islam wants a lot of confidence, a lot of self-respect.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir and visit us at our website parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A study published in November estimated that the COVID-19 death rate increased by 11% with an increase in the long-term average concentration of fine particulate matter of 1 microgram per cubic meter. Overall, approximately 15% of global COVID-19 deaths could be attributed to long-term exposure to air pollution, according to another paper published in December. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Lynn Peoples, writer. This article is published under the heading, With Winter Comes More Stagnant Air, Intensifying COVID-19 Risks in the U.S. Stay tuned for the details. For 7 straight days in early November, air pollution levels in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, exceeded limits set to protect public health. Unusually warm weather had triggered a hazardous temperature inversion. A low layer of cold air along with other airborne particles near the ground. Vehicle exhaust, wood smoke, industrial releases became trapped beneath a lid of warmer air. It was very noticeable to me, said a resident who lives about 30 minutes outside of Pittsburgh. Her house is less than a mile from an industrial plant, Clerton Coke Works, that converts coal into coke to manufacture steel. On at least one of those early November days, she recalled waking up in the wee hours of the morning to a bad stench. Throat irritation plagued her nearly every day. Such air inversions, which are a natural weather phenomenon, are most common during winter months when the sun supplies less warmth to the Earth's surface. Valleys and basins are especially prone to inversions, as surrounding hills or mountains can act as walls to block the wind and further lock in cold air and pollutants. With the approaching winter and the lingering, in some cases, spiking threat of COVID-19, susceptible regions such as Pennsylvania's Mon Valley, Utah's Salt Lake Valley, and California's coast-to-mountains basin that includes Los Angeles may face a double whammy. Studies suggest that poor air quality can worsen COVID-19's toll on the body as well as increase in its ability to spread. We are now talking about 2 pandemics. Thomas Menzel, a cardiologist at Johns Gutenberg University in Mainz, Germany, told EHN, "We have a pollution pandemic and we have the COVID pandemic." As Menzel explained, both pollution particles and the novel coronavirus target cardiovascular and respiratory systems in the body, triggering, similarly, dangerous inflammation and dysfunction. There are clear signs that air pollution hugely aggravates the outcome of patients infected with COVID-19, he said. A 2003 paper found that SARS coronavirus 1, a virus that belongs to the same family as the virus that causes COVID-19, patients from moderately polluted regions in some countries had an 84% elevated risk of dying from that virus compared to patients from regions with low levels of air pollution. A study published in November estimated that COVID-19 death rate increased by 11% with an increase in the long-term average concentration of fine particulate matter of 1 microgram per cubic meter. Overall, approximately 15% of global COVID-19 deaths could be attributed to long-term exposure to air pollution, according to another paper published in December. Further studies from around the world appear to support the link. Exposure to air pollution, both acutely and chronically, increases the lethality and severity of COVID infections. Brian Monick, president of Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, told EHN, "We can add this pandemic to all other reasons why air pollution is a serious health hazard." He noted a November study in which researchers estimated that air pollution caused between 2,500 and 8,000 premature deaths per year in Utah. Air pollution may also facilitate the spread of COVID-19 through a community. Brian Monick, president of Utah Physicians, said in a statement, "Recent studies hint at how the coronavirus may hitch rides on pollution particles. And when you're talking about really microscopic particles, those things can stay suspended in the air for much longer and can travel," said Monick. "That is probably one of the reasons why it doesn't appear as though the social distancing dictum of 6 feet separation is enough. Stagnant air during an inversion can rapidly worsen air quality. One study linked winter temperature inversions with an average increase of 40% or more in daily fine particulate matter pollution across large areas of the United States." Monique noted that most major cities do have worse fine particulate matter levels in the winter, at least in the absence of wildfires due to inversions preventing pollution from dispersing both vertically and laterally. However, inversions are not a one-size-fits-all event, he said. If there is a snow on the ground, for example, that can decrease the surface temperature and intensify an inversion and resulting buildup of pollution at ground level. Many of the communities that experience poor air quality, such as Clareton and parts of Salt Lake Valley, tend to also be less affluent and have a larger proportion of racial minorities. These same populations face greater risks from coronavirus due to crowded housing conditions, disproportionate representation in essential work settings, inequitable health care access, and discrimination. Minority groups also have higher rates of certain underlying medical conditions that increase the risk of severe illness from COVID-19, such as asthma, obesity, and diabetes. One study found that black people were twice as likely to catch the virus than white people. Another estimated that black people were more than three times as likely to die from the infection than white people. "We're looking at a racial justice or injustice issue," said Patterson, adding that her own community lacked accessible COVID-19 testing in early days of the pandemic. While current forecasts paint a grim picture for the COVID-19 pandemic in the weeks and perhaps months ahead, holiday gatherings, experts warn, are likely to trigger more surges. A pair of promising vaccines could bring welcome relief to millions of Americans this winter. The problem is, you can vaccinate against COVID, but you can't vaccinate against air pollution, said Menzel. So when the COVID pandemic is finished, we still have the pollution pandemic in the U.S. No one is immune. Rachel Filippini, executive director of the Group Against Smog and Pollution in Pittsburgh, underscored the point. No one is immune in the U.S. to air pollution. It is not good for any of us, Filippini told EHN. It is known to affect your respiratory system, cardiovascular system, just about every aspect of your health, she added. Inversions are also nothing new to vulnerable communities in the U.S. In late October 1948, for example, an inversion event intensified the deadly smog in Dinora, Pennsylvania. And in late December 2019, another warm front triggered an inversion in Mon Valley, a cluster of townships outside Pittsburgh. Residents endured 6 days of stinky, polluted air. Future winters could prove even worse, as research suggests climate change may be increasing both the frequency and severity of inversion events in the U.S.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.